is the other thing, that when you've got the TV's not working terribly well, maybe not so much nowadays with digital signals, but in the past when the TV wasn't working very well, and you go up and fiddle with the aerial, and the picture would improve, then you sit down again, and oh, finally watch TV. Then the picture will get worse again, then you go up again, and it gets better again. It goes on forever. The reason being that your body is acting as an antenna. You know, your body is 85% water or whatever. It's highly electrically conductive. It's quite big. It's bigger than most radio antennas. Therefore, it's going to attract atmospheric electricity will be absorbed by your body. When you then touch the radio, or the TV in this case, some of the broadcast signal goes through your body, which acts as quite an efficient antenna, into the TV, improves the picture, and as soon as you sit down again, it's lost the extra antenna assistance that it had, and the picture gets bad again, you know? So, you know, you'd be surprised what kind of crude methods can sometimes be employed to achieve these kind of results.
In the back?
It's probably a bit too technical, but whether the speech is interrupted by the white noise.
Yeah.
Did they do experiments where they varied the intensity of the white noise? Because it actually seemed too loud.
Yeah.
And sort of hid the syllables that you would have invented.
Yeah.
And you sort of, your ear almost blocked out the other bits of the sound.
The answer to your specific question is I don't know whether they, you know, I presume they must have experimented with volume levels in order to get that effect. You know, I've tried to replicate that experiment with difficulty, but I didn't really stick with it for very long. But you know, so that kind of, kind of undermines my presentation a little bit. But having said that, the technique of so-called phonemic restoration, as it's sometimes referred to, is used a lot by sound designers in films. Not so much nowadays, but in the past, another problem with magnetic tape recording, open reel tape recorders and stuff like that, is that bits of oxide would often fall off the tape. You know, you're rolling the tape through over and over again and it gets damaged. So, you know, if you've employed a bunch of really expensive actors, hired movie stars to voice dialogue for a film, and then there's a bit missing from one of the tapes because the oxide fell off, what do? You know, you don't want to employ X actor at sort of, you know, £100,000 a day again. You know, so a technique that's used by cinema sound designers is where they put a sort of, you know, the sound of a car horn or a gunshot or some plates falling down or whatever over the bit of missing sound. And again, the mind fills in the thing. And most listeners, you know, it's an established technique for sort of rescuing dodgy voice recordings in cinema sound design. So it's kind of, you know, there are many contexts in which these kind of tricks are used as art, as well as science, if you see what I mean.
There was a very interesting demonstration of an audio illusion.
Yeah.
By someone. He was developing a speech recognition system and he wanted it to work over the telephone.
Yeah.
The telephones don't transmit high frequencies.
Yeah.
So he was devising a box which would listen for the sibilance and then send a beep down the phone.
Yeah.
And so he played me a recording of somebody saying six, and the two beeps, which occurred as the two sibilants happened at the beginning and the end.
Right.
And when I listened to that, I heard six, beep, beep.
Yeah.
And he said, no, that is not what's on the tape.
Yeah.
The beeps are exactly coincident with the ends of the six, but the brain separates them completely into a word and two noises.
Wow, yeah. So, I mean, on Albert Rogan's CD that I borrowed this demonstration clip from. He wrote this enormous book called Auditory Scene Analysis, which is published by MIT Press, and there's 30 or 40 demonstrations on there, and some of them are pretty similar to what you're describing, to do with how the mind kind of moves, specifically beeps, around according to how they kind of relate to each other in different aspects of auditory space. So, you know, you might want to borrow that from an ogre or something, because it's an amazing book.
Can people wait for the mic? Just because I know that it's sometimes hard for people at the front to hear those at the back. It's helpful if it comes out of speakers.
Why do you think our brains still do this? Is there an evolutionary reason for why we fill in these gaps and quite often draw the wrong conclusion?
Well, that's the thing. I think that's a point that I hinted at earlier on, is that, you know, people are in, when you excuse me, most people are sort of familiar with the general idea of an illusion. It's a picture by M.C. Escher, or it's one of those kind of weird pictures you see in the psychology textbook or sometimes in a magazine or something like that. Or when people tend to think of, well, if you misheard something, well, it's just a mishearing. I mean, people often say that it's just a mishearing. They don't think of it, mishearings, as being produced by the mind for a particular purpose. And as a former colleague of mine who sort of runs a department called, the departmental name refers to anomalous psychology, for instance, which I think is, it's kind of, you know, in relation to parapsychology research, which is fair enough on one level, but I think both the sort of language of psychology of illusion and the language of anomalous phenomena can kind of be slightly misleading in some respects, because I think the most valuable lesson that you can learn from studying these kind of phenomena is about how the mind itself works. I mean, that's by no means an original statement on my part. And further to that, you know, these illusions manifest into the mind is kind of using an aspect of sort of creative or projective interpretation all the time. As demonstrated by kinetic depth effect illusion, by the blind spot phenomenon, by various aspects of mishearing, so on and so forth, lots of other different types of illusions, and that those, the faculties that generate those illusions are the same processes that generate reality, and that those faculties emerge as an aspect of evolutionary biology. The reason they emerge as aspects of evolution is because we need them in order to be able to make sense of our environment. It's because of things like this that we don't fall down flights of stairs or electrocute ourselves or burn ourselves when we're making tea on the kettle and all these kind of hazards that we face in the real world. And part of the, you know, there are many reasons why we need these kind of one of the reasons we need these interpretive faculties is to fill in for missing information. But also we need to use interpretive faculties in order to speed up the kind of processing that we need to perform in order to make sense of the world. So, for instance, there's some very good, interesting corroborative evidence for this that Sophie Scott, who's a professor at UCL Speech Something Lab, I forget the exact nomenclature, they do these experiments where my kind of discourse about all this kind of stuff is out of date, really, to be honest, because most of the kind of cutting-edge research nowadays is done with kind of brain scanning and MRI experiments. And they have an experiment where they demonstrate that when people are listening to speech, they use less mental energy, less, you know, absorption of oxygen from blood in the brain than when they're listening to environmental noise. And this is perfectly consistent with this idea that once you know that a certain word represents a kind of semantic unit, there's a kind of generalized, abstracted representation of something in your mind that you can recall from memory, you don't have to analyse the precise detail of it in order to make sense of it. You just kind of, as long as you recognise the beginning of a word and it sort of sits plausibly within the context of other words, you know, based on your knowledge of your spoken language, you can kind of get the beginning of it and just kind of guess the rest. So, you know, the mind actually, it's actually easier for the mind, once so trained, to interpret speech than it is to interpret completely sort of ambiguous noises. Which is why you have to make an effort sometimes to listen to unclear recordings. It is actually physically an effort. The role of evolution in that is, in that, hopefully, as I've described it, sort of self-evident. We need these faculties in order to be able to navigate the world, not only to navigate the world, but to navigate the world quickly.
I was wondering, you say listening to speech should be easier. Presumably, if you listen to a foreign language that you don't understand, is that harder than environmental or just somewhere in between?
Well, it depends on where you...
I'm assuming it's something that you... Well, I suppose... I would imagine it would shade, does it? If you sort of half understand a language, like I've got some understanding of French, that would...
It would help me, I mean, an example I can think of is that I go to a talk and somebody says his dad had cochlear implants. He was profoundly deaf and had cochlear implants. Because a lot of deaf people don't like cochlear implants. Some do, some don't. Reason being that if you were if you've grown used to being deaf and coping with the world without sound or reduced hearing, you know, you develop quite good coping strategies to get used to. And then if you have cochlear implants fitted, you've got kind of bionic ears, and suddenly you're blasted with noise that you can't interpret, or you have to relearn how to interpret this noise, because it's, the signals you receive aren't the same as what you would have known when you had normal hearing, right? And this guy described that his, you know, so a lot of people, deaf people, feel that having cochlear implants fitted is an imposition, because they, you know, they've learned to deal with the world. Anyway, this chap described to me that his dad had been to, had cochlear implants fitted, insisted that he had to learn how to, you know, cope with these new sounds, and went to a football match and found it totally overwhelming, totally exhausting, and slept for 18 hours when he got home from the football match, because he was bombarded with this loud sound that he had to make so much mental effort to interpret. You know, and you kind of tend to think of mental effort as being almost a metaphor, but it is in fact a physically real thing, that your energy, your body burns more energy, more sugar and more oxygen and so forth, in order to make the computations that go on inside your brain. So if you think you're working hard to make sense of something, you actually are physically, physiologically working to achieve that, and it's going to be very, very tiring.
Yeah.
And you can actually measure the level of mental exhaustion from MRI experiments and stuff.
An example of your halfway in between might be if you listen to somebody speaking what's nominally the same language, but with a very, very strong accent. So not using any dialect, they're using words you should recognise, but the accent is so extreme compared with your experience that you have to make an effort to listen.
Yes, or the rhythm pattern is different. That's another one that really, I find, throws me.
I was going to ask about, well, kind of think aloud about Chinese whispers, which were in my head at the end of your talk.
Yeah.
One of the things I'd heard is that the process of whispering, because it doesn't have the depth of the tones of the voice, it just has the sibilants.
Yeah, like you was
you,
saying
you
earlier
lose
on.
Lose the vowel kind of depth and roundness. And
yeah.
It takes a lot of the character out of the voice, which is apparently why playing a game with Chinese whispers, you can't do it with Chinese talking in a low voice. It doesn't work, because you hear more clearly. You have to whisper, and that's what then the brain interprets as wrong.
Yeah.
Did you come across anything to do with whispering in your
Well, I certainly talk about Chinese whispers as a game, because one of the interesting things about Chinese whispers is that it exists in virtually every culture in the world, as far as I can work out. There are versions of it. It's called Soromimi in Japan, for instance. Broken telephone whisper down the line. It has lots of different names and lots of different languages. So, you know, people have exploited similar phenomena, you know, essentially a sort of psychoacoustic joke to develop games in all different cultures, as far as I can work out.
Do EVP researchers consider whispers to count or not?
Yeah, I guess it would. I mean, I've never come across any specific reference to whispering as opposed to any other type of speech sound, to be honest, in that context. You know, I know that during the war, you know, one of the reasons you have this kind of characteristic sort of radiostatic kind of thing is because speech systems, I believe, were deliberately filtered to emphasise the sibilants. Firstly, because sibilants carry most information, I believe, sort of in kind of information processing terms about the speech. But more importantly, because, you know, when pilots in the war were in the cockpit, you know, there's tons of engine noise, which tended to be low frequency. So if they got the speech systems to kind of concentrate on the high frequencies, that would kind of cut through the background noise a bit. So you have that kind of characteristic wartime ambience of kind of crackly radios, and it's not because, as most people presume, the transmission systems were of poor quality. It was actually deliberately designed in order to allow speech to kind of ride over sort of combat sounds of one sort or another. But really, I don't know is the answer to your specific question. Yeah.
Come around. Yeah, with respect to that, I was thinking if you have the words tonal language, like Chinese, for instance, where the meaning changes whether you say it up or down.
Oh, yeah. What's the word? Is it prosody?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a big thing in Basque as well.
Are there any studies how that affects the cognition and perception of things?
I'm sure there are, yeah. I mean, I said Basque is because I gave a talk in Basque Country last year, and apparently there's tons of really interesting stuff about this written by Basque scholars that's never been translated, Mm. And apparently Basque is more similar to Japanese than it is to French or Spanish. I mean, it's not actually related, but I mean, in terms of how it operates, because there are things where meaning changes according to what sort of pitch, relative pitch you use. But I mean, to some extent, that's... happens in English as well, and unfortunately I can't remember the example offhand, but I've got a book called, what's it called, A Guide to Pilot Speech Communications or something like that, about air traffic control, and they give a sample sentence where placing the emphasis on, it has five words in the sentence, and you can place the emphasis on any of the five different words, and by changing the emphasis, i.e. the relative pitch of the words in the sentence, it completely changes the meaning of the sentence. So it's lexically exactly the same sentence, exactly the same letters, but you know that. So pitch is much more important in, I understand, I don't know much about languages, but in Chinese and Japanese and Basque. But equally, it is important in English as well, in that sense.
On that point, the example I thought you were going to use was Motherese.
What's that?
Which is a sort of pseudo language that all cultures in the world are supposed to have, which is the language that mothers use to talk to their children.
Yeah.
And it's a good example of how pitch alone can be used to store information.
Yeah.
So, and apparently, just there are conserved sort of sequences of tones that communicate a set series of like emotions from a mother to that child. Like,
yeah.
If you end with a certain intonation, that means I'm angry.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's extremely interesting what you said. I've never heard of that before, but
I've heard from Steven Pinker.
Right. Because with the McGurk effect, I think it's no coincidence that the kind of sounds they're talking about, mumma, dada, you know, these kind of parental type sounds. And I think one of the reasons that the projective aspects of relationship between visual and auditory information in hearing manifests so vividly in the McGurk effect demonstration video is because of the specific sounds that they use, and that probably relates to exactly what you're talking about, because the reason people lip read is originally and primarily because when tiny babies are really little, you know, they watch their mum or dad's face, and the mum or dad goes, mum, my dad, that, mum, my dad. So the relationship between the focusing on the eyes and the lips and the throat and those specific group of quite limited sounds are the most primal linguistic experiences that anyone has, which is why the McGurk effect has sort of accidentally sort of focused, zeroed in on those specific kind of group of sounds, I think. You know, and developmental psychology has a lot to do with how the relationship between speech and lip reading emerges. So, for instance, André-Marie Ampère, who, you know, the guy we know from the phrase amps, wrote some very interesting stuff about how if you're listening to the opera, you might not be able to discern the words of the libretto, but if you have the script printed in front of you, then suddenly you can hear more clearly. Similarly, some people wrote to New Scientist magazine reporting that they actually hear better when they're wearing their glasses and hear worse when they're taking them off, things like that. So being able to see a speaker's face, not just, you know, psychologists tend to refer to face reading rather than lip reading, the more general term, because it's also to do with the movement of the whole face as well as the lips. But being able to see a speaker's face in relation to a kind of distorted recording is equivalent to increasing the volume of the recording by sort of 12 decibels or something like that in terms of people's ability to interpret the words correctly. So,
yeah. Fascinating. I think we'd better bring it to a close. We're a little bit over our normal time. Big thanks, obviously, to the museum for allowing us to use their space, to Oxford Bioscience Network, who are our sponsors, to my glamorous helpers who have helped me clear up. Please do feel free to chat to Joe a bit more while we're doing that, because otherwise they'll be very bored. And no, you don't need any help, so don't worry about joining in. Thank you very much, all of you, for coming. And second Tuesday of the month, carry on through the summer. Look at the website for more details. Thank you very much.